going to do this on a blank page.
Okay, we're going to start our course in philosophy of religion. Our textbook, we're going to use Dr. Norman Geisler's Philosophy of Religion textbook. He co-authored it with Winfried Cordouan. And let's give a brief definition of philosophy. I don't want to give a real advanced definition like we gave in our introduction to philosophy, but philosophy comes from two Greek words, philos, which means love, and sophia, which means wisdom. And so basically, contrary to the way philosophy is practiced and the way it looks today, philosophy is supposed to be the love of wisdom. So then when you enter in the subject of religion, religion is how man views reality and how man, we're going to give a more technical definition of religion in a little while, but basically how man responds to God or the ultimate being, that type of thing. So, philosophy of religion would be seeking wisdom about religious issues and debating such things as God's existence and the problem of evil. We're going to talk about religious experience. We're going to define it, talk about some of its characteristics, some of the dimensions of religious experience, and try to verify the reality of religious experience. That covers about one-fourth of Geisler's textbook. We're going to talk about religious language, which covers about another fourth of his textbook. Then we'll be talking about different worldviews, such as atheism and pantheism, and we'll give evidence for God's existence. That's going to be a good portion of our course. We're going to probably spend at least four lectures on evidence for God's existence, and we're going to try to dialogue on that, have question and answer time, things of that sort. We're going to discuss the problem of evil. How could an all-good and an all-powerful God coexist with evil and human suffering? Some things that Geisler doesn't touch on in his book that we'll be talking about will be the problem of miracles. Some philosophers think that miracles have been disproved as impossible for miracles to occur. Miracles are violations of natural laws that science has discovered, and therefore, since they cannot be violated, miracles cannot occur. We're going to try to show that miracles can occur. And then we're even going to spend at least one lecture on divine sovereignty and human free will, trying to reconcile the two, which is going to be an overlap, some overlap with our lectures on soteriology in that area. But for lecture number one, the philosophy of religion, we need to talk about religious experience. Now we're not talking about, when we say religious experience, I'm not the type of Christian who goes around saying, I had a vision last night, an 8-foot Jesus appeared to me, or some angels appeared to me. But that does not mean that I have not had a religious experience. But by religious experience, you can mean either some individual experience that you think you have with God, or you can mean by that the Christian walk, your experience as a believer. And that's, we're using it in a more generic way, okay? No one would deny that Phil Fernandez has had a religious experience since he accepted Christ. The atheist wouldn't deny that. What he would deny is that there's no objective reality behind that experience. It's all subjective. It's all just feelings and emotions. And these changes occur because I got a warm, fuzzy feeling inside, but there's no objective reality behind it. But we want to define first then what we mean by religious experience. By the way, the final exam is going to be 15 essay questions. And they're pretty in-depth. And the only way to get those essay questions correct is really to master Geisler's textbook. And I will cover everything that I think you need to know from this textbook to master it, plus some other information as well. But what I'm thinking of doing is such a tough test that what I'm thinking of doing, my master degree student, he didn't know what was going to be on this, but I'm thinking of handing that test out early so that as you go through your studies through the week, you're studying this information, you can begin to write the answers from your notes, from your reading, and then you study that knowing that that is what's going to be on the test. Because as easy as that sounds right now, if you can get those 15 essay questions right, and most of them will take about half a page just to skim the surface, what I'm pretty much doing is the 15 questions just about outline guys in the book. But I think you'll get a better understanding if you go through it once, open book, and then later on, even with no surprise, you'll go through the whole test knowing what's going to be on it. Because it's not my goal to just fool anybody, but it is my goal to give you a pretty good knowledge of this, the information from this course. Religious experience is defined as awareness. So again, it's not a one-time experience, but it's an awareness of the transcendent. Awareness of the transcendent. Now, the transcendent, Geisler defines that as that which goes beyond, or is more than one's immediate consciousness. Let me repeat that. The transcendent is that which goes beyond, or is more than one's immediate consciousness. Now, for something to be transcendent in a religious sense, of the usage of that word, it must be believed to be ultimate. The ultimate means to be the greatest being, that which is worthy of ultimate respect, that which is worthy of worship. Must be believed to be the ultimate. Religious experience, in fact, I think Geisler spells it out. I don't know what page. The end of one of his chapters in the first. Page 39, the first two sentences. He says, religious experience is universal. We'll get to that point a little ways from now. The second sentence he says, religious experience involves two basic elements. This is the first question that's going to be in your final. This is an easy one. And then from there on, the questions get longer and longer. But it involves two basic elements, an awareness of the transcendent and a total commitment to the transcendent. Religious experience involves two basic elements, an awareness of the transcendent, Christians call the transcendent God, and a total commitment to the transcendent. We call that total commitment worship. And so religious experience is total commitment to the transcendent ultimate being. Okay? So there's two elements there, and keep those in mind. That will be on the test. Religious experience is more than just moral experience. A lot of people say, are you a Christian? Oh yeah, I'm a Christian. I'm nice to people. I do good things. And they equate Christianity with being a morally nice person. But religious experience, if we're going to understand what it is, we need to recognize that it goes beyond moral experience. Ethical or moral experience responds, this is what Soren Kierkegaard said, he hit the nail right in the head here, even though a lot of what he said was way out in left field. But Kierkegaard was right at this point. Ethical experience is man's response to the moral law, that which is right and that which is wrong. Ethical experience is response to the moral law, but religious experience responds to the moral law giver. Religious experience responds to the moral law giver.
So you could say, what is the relation and what is the action?
In one sense, yes, but I would even go so far to say that like the Pharisees, they were having a religious experience, but they had made the ultimate not God, but God's law. That's what being legalistic is all about. So you could still have a religious experience, but you can make something less than ultimate. You can consider that your ultimate being. It's called idolatry. With the Pharisees, their false idol was they put God's law above God. They were looking at the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. They were trying to save themselves by their adherence to the law and not recognizing that they were falling short and in need of a Savior. But when we rightly understand it, the moral experience, religious experience, goes beyond moral experience. It doesn't just respond to the moral law, it responds to the moral law giver, the ultimate being. Religious experience, Geigler and Cordovan, by the way, I had the opportunity of meeting Winfried Cordovan on one occasion too, and he's a really nice guy. I met Geigler too, but Geigler's a nice guy, he's been on a bad day, but Cordovan's a really, real, real nice guy. I had Chinese food with him and a few other philosophers and stuff in San Francisco for the Evangelical Theological Society. But Cordovan is a real nice guy. Religious experience, Geisner and Cordovan argue, is universal. And this is real important. What they're saying is that man is incurably religious. There is no such thing as a non-religious man. Everybody who denies the existence of God, if you talk to them or watch them long enough, you'll find that they've got a God somewhere. Maybe they're just so selfish that after a while you start to realize that they've made themselves God. They're their own God. They're the king of their own universe. They're worshiping something else. For instance, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, he said that the fundamental human project was man's desire to be God. He said even he himself, he desired to be God. But even there, Sartre believed that God doesn't exist. He believed that if man is totally free, if man is autonomous, self-governs himself, and no one can tell him what to do, then God can't exist. Because either God exists and then man is not free, or man is free and God doesn't exist. He believes that man is free, so God doesn't exist. But even his autonomy, the fact that he wants man to be free and nobody above man can tell man what to do, in essence, he really has made himself. He has made man a God. We come into existence undefined. We define ourselves. God didn't design us to be a certain way. We can be whatever we want to be. We need to actualize ourselves. But he openly admitted that man, basically all men, desire to be their own God. I don't want to get too much into Sartre's thought here. He basically believed because God doesn't exist, there's no meaning or purpose to life. But man desperately needs meaning and purpose to life, so we just create our own meaning. We actualize ourselves, we authenticate ourselves, even though there really is no meaning to life. But he did say that the fundamental human project is the desire to be God. And it sounds a lot like when Satan deceived Adam and Eve, he finally got them to disobey God, or when he told them that if they disobeyed God, they would be like God, knowing good and evil. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to say, what you're saying is the dependent desires to be hidden things.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, is even though Sartre would say that we're free, another existentialist, a German existentialist, I believe a German Heidegger, talked about man just being thrown into existence with no choice no matter whatsoever. And others would talk about an ultimate dependency. And so that is very common among existentialist writers. But Sartre would, because of his big emphasis on free will, he would also, you could express it that way. Man really desires to be totally independent when he realizes that he isn't. Although, at the same, the other side of that coin, Sartre's got a big emphasis on man's freedom and man's autonomy. Sigmund Freud, although he was an atheist, you know, Sartre was an atheist as well. But Sigmund Freud, he was an atheist, but he tried to explain why mankind believes in God. So he said that mankind has this illusion of God. This wish, he wishes for a cosmic comforter who would comfort him and take away his fears and take away his guilt. But by Freud saying that, Freud's examining human beings, Freud is really saying, even though Freud didn't believe that this cosmic comforter existed, Freud denied the existence of God, but what he's actually saying, though, is same thing that Geisler and Corduan, two Christians, are saying, man is incurably religious. So just the fact that he's got to explain why mankind universally has accepted some type of concept of God. By his trying to explain that away, even he's admitting to this universal belief in God. Friedrich Schleiermacher, and the pronunciation there is probably a little weak, he said that there's a universal, among mankind, a universal feeling of cosmic dependence. This is what you were talking about there. And Schleiermacher, he's talking even about those who are not Christians. This feeling of dependence. I am not in full control. I depend on certain things for my existence. We need oxygen, we need food to exist. And this feeling of cosmic dependence, like there's something out there that we're dependent on, even if we're atheists. Walter Kaufman, an atheist, he took Friedrich Nietzsche's writings and translated a lot of them and put them in a book, a collection of Friedrich Nietzsche's writings, and called them the Portable Nietzsche. And Nietzsche, by the way, is what I believe is the most consistent atheist who ever lived. He could have coined the phrase, God is dead, and basically said that traditional values have died with him. But Kaufman defined man as the God-intoxicated ape. So he said, evolutionist doesn't believe there's God, but the thing that separates us from the ape is we're so intoxicated with this idea of God. So even he would admit that man is incurably religious. And he might not like the way we phrase it, but religious experience is universal. You know, Bertrand Russell, an atheist, you say you have the dogmatic religious people over here on this side, and then you got the free thinkers like me on this side. And those religious people have killed so many people. Look at all the thousands of people that got killed in the Crusades. But I'm a free thinker. I'm an agnostic, and he basically was an atheist and focused on agnostic, but I'm a free thinker. I don't believe that God exists, and I'm a free thinker. And so if you turn to Bertrand Russell, who claimed to be totally non-religious, to be religious and to be dogmatic, and to be one of these evil people that's killed so many people, if you turn to him and say, well, the communists are atheists, and they killed millions of people in the century, more than any, than all the people that have ever been killed in wars in the history of mankind. So atheists, the people who agree with you, kill more people than religious people have. Russell turns around and says, yeah, but the communists were dogmatic in their atheism, unlike me. And Bertrand Russell, but why I'm not a Christian, one of the most dogmatic atheistic works I've ever read, he would classify, he classified the communists as religious people. So what Bertrand Russell basically did was say, you got the religious people and the free thinkers, and all those rotten people that kill lots of people, they're the religious people, and the free thinkers are all the nice people on this side and over here. And but I think a lot of the, when you read a lot of the writings of these other atheists, there would not be a lot of agreement with Bertrand Russell. That Bertrand Russell was putting himself in a classification that was just in an unreal world. Bertrand Russell said that, yeah, dogmatism means that you hold certain views dogmatically. You believe that certain things are definitely true. Skepticism means you suspend judgment on all things. Well, I read a quote from Bertrand Russell where he said something that he thought was profound. He was a much wiser man than me, but he put his foot in his mouth on this statement. But he said, look, to be skeptical, the skeptic is as dogmatic in his skepticism as the dogmatist is in his dogmatism. What he meant by that was that skepticism is very dogmatic that we should suspend judgment on all things. He's dogmatic about being a skeptic. So the skeptic who thinks he's the opposite of the skeptic is just as dogmatic as the dogmatist is. And so Bertrand Russell, then, that's very profound. He's right on there. But then the conclusion that Bertrand Russell makes is that therefore we shouldn't be either dogmatic or skeptic. We should be find some middle ground. My question to him would be, you sound to me, Mr. Russell, like you're pretty dogmatic that we should hold to this middle ground. And you see, what Bertrand Russell failed to realize, and I don't know why, because he's a very wise man, maybe he was just running from the evidence, but there is no escape from dogmatism. You have people that dogmatically believe certain things, then you have people who claim to be skeptics, but in reality are dogmatically skeptical. And then you have people who claim to be free of both, and they're in the middle of the road, but they're dogmatically in the middle of the road. So the question isn't, should we be dogmatic about something? We're human beings. We have to be dogmatic about something. We're incurably religious. Even the decision not to decide is a dogmatic decision not to decide. But we're going to make some decisions. We've got to have a view on something. We're incurably religious. The question isn't, should we be dogmatic about something? The question is, what are you going to be dogmatic about? The choice not to become a Christian is as much a choice as the choice to become a Christian. But mankind is incurably religious. This Bertrand Russell idea, you got the religious fanatics over here and the free thinkers over here. The free thinkers who are as fanatical in their quote-unquote free thinking and as dogmatic about it. The free thinkers were really free from blind faith and as free from accepting these dogmatic principles thrust on society through our parents. If the free thinkers were really as free in their thinking as they claim, then why are they always losing the debates? Why did Bertrand Russell get blown away by the Jesuit priest Frederick Coppersman when he debated God's existence? But whatever the case, religious experience is universal. Man is incurably religious. And we're going to turn back to that a little bit later. Some of the characteristics of religious experience. Again, this deals with those two things that we touched on page 39 in the textbook, where Tyson and Corderon said that religious experience is universal. It involves two basic elements, an awareness of the transcendent and a total commitment to the transcendent. So the two characteristics there, it involves an awareness of the transcendent. We find this in what Geisler and Corderon call the need for self-transcendence. This awareness of the transcendent, the need for self-transcendence. What they mean by that is religious experience involves the need to transcend, the need to rise above the unalterable displeasures of life. Okay, let me give you an example. Karl Marx, his utopian society, that was expressed, his idea that we need to do away with capitalism, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. We need to transcend ourselves, to transcend the unalterable displeasures of life, to get these capitalists out of power, and to eventually set up a utopian, classless society. Okay? That was his religion. He said religion is the opium of the people, but then he turned out to be as much of a religious fanatic as any of the people that he was slamming. Again, Walter Kaufman calls man the God-intoxicated ape. Jean-Paul Sartre says man's project is to become God, to transcend those things we're dependent on. And then Ludwig Feuerbach stated that God is the projection of the human's own nature. That God the Father doesn't really exist. We just, all the weaknesses that we have and the strength we wish we have, we project on an imaginary being and we call him God. God is everything that we want to be. We want to transcend our circumstances of our lives. We want to achieve the unachievable, so we invent a being who can achieve what is unachievable for us, and we worship him, and we hope and pray that he is going to be able to allow us to achieve that which we could not achieve on our own. So Feuerbach would say God is the projection of the human's own nature on an imaginary being, but the religious person is not aware of this. He really thinks that God exists when in actuality God did not create man, but man created God by his own imagination. But all of these guys are talking about the same thing, this need for self-transcendence, the fact that religious experience involves the need to transcend, to rise above the unalterable displeasures of life. John Warwick Montgomery, the Lutheran apologist, used to teach right out of Tacoma. But he argued that you cannot understand Marxism unless you view it as a Christian heresy. As a movement that, yes, hated Christianity, but tried to replace just about every major tenet that Christianity had. I mean, even the utopian classless society was kind of, when you throw Christianity out the window, there's a void there because there's a void there where the kingdom of God should be. And so he replaced the millennial kingdom with the utopian society. He replaced the concept of sin with, and viewed it economically as profit, going to evil capitalists who were keeping their workers in bondage. But this whole drama of life, the whole need to transcend the earthly experience and the earthly trials, even Marx couldn't escape that and basically came up with his own religion. So religious experience, the first characteristic, it involves an awareness of the transcendent, and secondly, it involves a total commitment or ultimate concern. Different scholars phrase that differently. Ian Ramsey referred to it as this religious experience as involving a total commitment. Paul Tillich referred to it as ultimate concern. Schleiermacher referred to it as man's feeling of absolute dependence. This is all what the Christian calls worship. This ultimate total commitment to the ultimate being. Okay? See, this is why creationism should be taught in the schools. Creation science should be taught in the public schools. They say, well, it's religious. The Supreme Court ruled in 1961, Turcaso versus Watkins, the Supreme Court ruled in that decision that secular humanism, the belief that there is no God and that all that exists is the material realm that we evolve, the Supreme Court ruled that secular humanism is as much a religion as the theistic religions, such as Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Therefore, if you could teach atheistic evolution in the public schools, if there is some scientific evidence for creation science, we should also be able to teach creation science. Teach them side by side and let the students decide. The idea that to say God exists is a religious statement, is expressing a religious view, but the statement God does not exist is not expressing a religious view, it's ludicrous. If one statement just merely negates the other statement, then you're still talking on the same subject matter. And they're both expressing religious views. But without total commitment, the experience is not religious. I like going to church because I like singing songs with people, and I like the way the preacher talked. If that's the only reason why I went to church, and I really didn't believe in Jesus, then I'm really not having a religious experience there. I'm just going because I like to be entertained. Okay? It's just a social club, so it's the company. But then after church, if I would go out and get drunk 7 nights a week and get involved in all kinds of immorality and sin, then I think it would be, even though I would go to church once a week, then I think there could be a good argument that my God is my own pleasure. Seeking pleasure is my religion. That's what my total commitment is. It just so happens I also find it pleasurable to sing songs and listen to this one preacher preach. But the ultimate commitment has to be there to find out what exactly a person's religion is. That's why, you could, where Christ said, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of God, but he does the will of my Father who is in heaven. You can say one thing with your lips, but wherever your ultimate commitment is, that's where your religion is. And so I think that needs to be reemphasized today. Of the dimensions of religious experience, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. It just confuses. You get confused. You get the first 5 or 6. I think I'm still confused on this. I sent the videotape to Norman Geisler after reading this book 5 or 6 times and lecturing on it several times. He probably still say I'm confused on it, but he tried to show the different dimensions of religious experience. He's talking about anti-theist or atheist merely replace, it's not that they're non-religious, they merely replace the traditional way of viewing God with another form of the transcendent. In other words, the guys who say there is no God, there's still something that they worship, they just fill the void left by their departure from God with something else. But they're worshiping something. Like the old Bob Dylan song, you gotta serve somebody. It might be the devil, it might be the Lord, but you gotta serve somebody. It might be yourself, you might be your own God. Or it might be some false Greek mythological God. Or it might be Buddha. But whatever it is, you've got to have some kind of God. So even atheists merely replace the traditional way of viewing God with another form of the transcendent, just like a lot of the world religions do. But even atheists cannot avoid transcendence. So Geisler says there's about seven different kinds of transcendence that have been developed, different ways to transcend, to try to replace that void. You know, Jesus Christ said, man does not live on bread alone, but every utterance of the mouth of God. What Jesus is saying is, look, man is more than just a physical being, he is also a spiritual being. And as a spiritual being, he needs to have a religious experience. And the only true way that that thirst for a spiritual experience is going to be quenched is if his thirst for God is quenched. But a lot of people don't want the God of the Bible, and they try to quench that thirst through other means. The seven ways that he mentions, I don't even think you're going to see this stuff on my desk, but seven kinds of transcendence, transcending backward. They find some primitive religions where they'll go through rituals that point back to man's origin. To their views of man's origin, how man came into existence. Transcending upward, where God is viewed as the highest being, and through mysticism, man can somehow rise up to God's level. The Neoplatonists came up with that view, the guys that, like Plotinus, that kind of took Plato's views a couple steps further than Plato took them. That God is on a higher realm, we need to transcend upward towards Him. Transcending outward. By the way, you see these dimensions also. Some of these dimensions, you'll see them as kind of partial descriptions of the transcendence within Christianity. But again, we're not transcending into the unknown and having a relationship with a God that we can't explain. We can't exhaustively explain God, but we can say some things. We know some things about Him. So it's not contentless, but you can see some elements of this that are similar to elements in Christian transcendence. Transcending outward, reaching the outermost limits of one's being. Transcending downward. This is common among guys that would demyth the Bible, take out the religious fairy tales of the Bible, they would say. A lot of liberal theologians will say God is not another being, but He is the depth and ground of all being. Will Tillich would be in this class. Transcending within, finding God within the depths of one's being. That sort of thing, I would think you'd find that real common among some of the pantheistic religions, some of the Eastern religions. Transcending forward, Karl Marx, his communistic goal of the utopian society, that we had to transcend forward. He got his views from Hegel, the dialectic rhythm. He left the realm of the antithesis, that if there's something is true, its opposite must be false. He said, no, you'll have something that is true, the thesis, you'll have its opposite, the antithesis, and as time goes on, you'll have a synthesis of the two. And at one time, capitalism was good for its time. But then you have the antithesis, the communistic state, where the government controls and operates everything, and then there's going to be a synthesis of the two, and it's going to end up with the utopian society. So as you're getting away backwards, you find Francis Schaeffer writing against that a lot. But Marx rightfully understood. He took the Hegelian dialectic, and he took that and applied that economically, and threw in his material, heavy emphasis on materialism and the denial of God's existence, whereas Hegel was coming from a more idealistic bent. But Marx was transcending forward. Even Hegel, though, too, was transcending forward as these triads of thesis, the antithesis, and then a synthesis coming from them. All history was moving forward. And that's the way Marx, he did. Well, he got rid of the God of the Bible, didn't want anything to do with him, but he had his own God as he was transcending forward towards his utopian goal. And then transcending in a circle, Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche argued that the German atheist, that there is a finite number of atoms in the universe, but given an infinite number of time, an infinite amount of time, because the universe is eternal, they would be shuffled in different sequences, to where eventually they're going to be reshuffled in the same sequence that they're in right now. In other words, there's going to be an eternal recurrence. We are damned or doomed to repeat the same events over and over and over and over and over again, on and on through all eternity. And so his transcendence was transcending in a circle. And that's probably one of the reasons why he died insane. And I'm not really going to focus that much, but what Geisel was trying to do there is, in Cordovan, even guys who deny God's existence have to transcend in some way. Mankind is incurably religious, and even the people who say, well, you're religious, you have religious faith, but I just base my views on the facts and on the evidence. That guy is just as religious as you are, and his beliefs are... good chance are not based on as much evidence as the Christian beliefs are, although there are a lot of Christians who just believe and don't look for evidence for their beliefs. But the evidence is out there. And then finally, Geisler and Cordovan look to verify the reality of religious experience. Okay, all mankind is having a religious experience. However, that doesn't necessarily mean God exists. And so they try to argue for it here. Now, they give stronger arguments for God's existence later on, but I do want to bring up this argument from religious experience. It's not one of the strongest arguments for God's existence, but they do make a pretty good case here. Verifying the reality of religious experience. Point number one, I'll simplify their argument here. All mankind, all people sense a basic need for God. That's number one, real important. All people sense a basic need for God. This feeling of absolute dependence. Sartre, they explain this in terms different than God, but Sartre, Kaufman, Freud, Schleiermacher, all those guys that we covered earlier. Yeah.
I was going to say, could you exchange the word God for independent? Maybe the independence looks for the independent or the transcendent. We're finite.
I would say
the finite looks for the infinite.
Yeah, in a certain degree. But even the thing is, though, too, it kind of encompasses even more than that. I mean, before I answer that question, let me just finish this, because I'll run out of time on the cassette before I run out of time on the video. All people sense a basic need for God, a feeling of absolute dependence, even atheists. Sartre even admitted that he really wanted God to exist, but then he supposedly realized God didn't exist, and it really crushed him. But even he admitted a basic need for God. all people's sense of basic need for God. Number two, what humans really need really exists. We really need water. Lo and behold, it exists. Now we might die of thirst in the desert. We need food. It does exist. But we might starve to death somewhere. We need air. We might be in a room with an airtight room and die, but it doesn't mean the air is there. Whatever humans really need really does exist. If all humans express this need for God, it seems that we really do need God. And if all our other real human needs really exist, then whether we find this God or not, it seems highly probable that God does really exist. If we really do need Him, it's highly probable that He does, in fact, exist. Now, we can keep running the video, but we're going to have to, the cassettes will be at the end here, but I'll try to answer your question here. I would say all people sense a basic need for the transcendent. I think that would be a better word. Or what the Christians call God, but that's even too specific. But the infinite, because like Sartre isn't so much looking for an infinite independent being. Sartre wants to be that infinite independent being. But he is looking for something that transcends life. A big part of transcendence, Mike Tyson, the greatest dream, win a heavyweight title. He wins it, and it's not anything he thought it would be. Everything that we